At this point, I would like to ask Annette, our Vice President, to introduce our speaker for tonight.
Thank you. I confess to a silly habit. I read my horoscope every morning. Of course, it depends on the source as to whether it is amusing, inspiring, or just downright annoying. This morning's horoscope for me said that I needed to go water my houseplants, and that if I didn't have any houseplants, I needed to go bring some in, because I needed to care for all the organic things in my life to remind me of how important my roots are. This afternoon for a few hours, and tomorrow for a few more hours, I'll have an opportunity to spend time with people that I share ancestral roots. And I now am going to introduce you to one of my professional colleagues, someone that I feel very close to professionally. Michael Bird is a native Georgian. He was educated at the Citadel and was granted 2 masters from USC, a master's in social work and a master's in public health, and continued his work at USC and received a PhD. He also served for a few years as a fellow in long-term care with the University of Minnesota. Dr. Bird has worked in the field of public health in a variety of settings. He just reminded me that he started out working at State Hospital, and my first field work was at State Hospital. And he went on to be a regulator with nursing homes. He decided then that he wanted to devote the rest of his career to trying to help people stay out of both. He currently holds a position as Clinical Assistant Professor, Arnold School of Public Health, USC Columbia, specializing in health services policy and management. Dr. Bird provides numerous hours of professional and greater community service. This audience might be particularly interested in his memberships in the South Carolina Historical Association and the South Carolina Library. Dr. Bird has received numerous educational and professional awards. And I'll mention the first one. It was first honor graduate at the Citadel upon receipt of his baccalaureate. And most recently, the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors 2010 Leadership Award. Some years ago, my interest in the history of professional social work in South Carolina brought me to conversations with Dr. Bird about his doctoral research. Dr. Bird studied the origins of social welfare in colonial South Carolina. He had several interests shared by members of this group. He could talk about the Swiss at Currysburg. He could talk about the German-Friendly Society of Charleston. He could talk about why we are so passionate about genealogy and other topics. We asked Dr. Bird to begin his presentation this evening with some of the conditions experienced by our colonial ancestors, immigrants from Western Europe, as they arrived on the coast of colonial North America. I will say that many of us would like to find positions of power in our ancestors, people with considerable means. We might even want to find people with pedigrees, royal backgrounds. But the truth for more of our ancestors included some of the same struggles that we find today. When all goes well, we're able to provide for ourselves and we're able to provide for our loved ones. We might even prosper at times. When illnesses, disabilities, household deaths, economic downturns afflict us and our families, struggles ensue. We need to look to others. Dr. Bird, we want to hear what you have to say about poverty and relief in parts of colonial South Carolina, and in fact, whatever else you want to talk about. Welcome, Dr. Bird.
Thanks so much for having me here, and thanks, Annette, for that introduction. I've worked on this topic since 1971. No one has ever asked me to talk about it. I was excited. Last night, the lecture is on YouTube on emerging infectious diseases. Dr. Eric Brenner, the World Health Organization, lectured in my class on Ebola. And today I presided over a meeting of the South Carolina Cancer Alliance on a new and less invasive method of lung cancer screening. So that's what I do, is chronic disease prevention, health policy and management. That's what I teach about. But I'm really passionate about this. And so I want to ask you, I ask my students lots of questions, so hopefully I can ask you questions and you can ask me any questions that you have. So why is it so important to us as humans to know about our roots, to understand our ancestors and who they were and how they lived, and know everything that we can know about them? Why do we need to do that? What do you think?
Diseases handed down from generation to generation.
That's really, really good. All of that is exactly right. So why else?
To appreciate the sacrifices they made.
Yeah, very good. Why else?
To know who we are.
Nope. Okay. That's it. That's what I was searching for. I keep working until I can get that. So thank you very much. So 4 million years ago, the earliest humans, their existence was very precarious. It's a balance between tiny microorganisms, viruses, and parasites and bacteria. And every time that they would get a little bit ahead, the bugs would catch up. For 4 million years, the leading cause of death was infectious disease. At some point, humans began to walk upright and develop the capacity to speak and communicate vocal cords language. And at that point, and somewhat afterwards, culture originated. Human culture, a really important part of making us who we are as humans. And a part of that was a sense of belonging to a tribe, to a group, and a sense of altruism, caring for people who were vulnerable, who were... Why was it important to care for elders within a tribe or a family group? Why do you think that's important? Why? Those are the source of the culture. They know the culture and the stories about that tribe, and can pass that on. And so I don't know anything about genealogy, but I do know what you do is very important. And I'm proud if I can contribute anything to that. It's what you're doing is a basic part of what makes us human. And those human groups and families that were best at that, best at working together and caring for others, were those that survived and were able to pass their genes on into the future. So individuals did not evolve. Families and groups evolved and grew and passed on culture. So what you're doing is really important to the human condition. So thank you. And thanks again for asking me here. So I hope you will guide me in this. So 4 million years ago, everyone died of infectious disease. Everyone. Now there are two other general causes of death. And what I did for many years is to attempt to prevent one of the, really a couple of those, the other two causes of death. So you have infectious disease. For 4 million years, virtually everyone died of infectious disease, or the second general cause of death, which is what? Very good. You guys are so smart. So homicide, war, violent death, injury, second leading cause of death throughout all history. So as genealogists, it's a little bit associated with what I do in public health epidemiology, because we study death. It's not in a morbid sense, but we try to prevent it. The important thing to know is that most of your ancestors, not all of them, but most of them that came into South Carolina came in to Charlestown. And at the time, and very few countries or municipalities kept records of births and deaths. Charlestown did, and several other areas in the United States. There were only, at the time, let's say about 1750, a little bit before, there were only five cities in what's now the United States. So who can name all five?
In what year?
1750. 1730 to 1750.
Philadelphia.
Boston.
New York.
Charlestown. Charlestown.
Savannah.
Newport. The others were little tiny villages. And so in some of those they kept birth and death records, which is the basic science of public health. And they kept some records. Where this originated was, of course, in England. So comparing mortality rates, it's deaths per thousand people, the mortality rate in Charlestown was at least twice that of any of the other places that kept records on the face of the earth. Twice. And some years, it was three or four times. But why was it three or four times in those particular years?
Scaring from Europe.
Malaria.
Scaring from Europe.
Look, you know, you're stealing all of my thunder. So after culture was developed and people began to work together, they were so skilled at working together, they managed to kill all of the large-bodied herbivores, the mammoths, the giant sloths, the large animals, to eat them. And they didn't have anything else to eat, so agriculture developed. And out of agriculture was the birth of civilization and the larger cultures that we know of today in Europe and Asia and South America. In those agricultural areas that were very successful, they began to do what? They farmed, right? What else do they do that's really a part and parcel of agriculture and farming? Domesticated animals. So most of our epidemic diseases that plagued Charleston came from domesticated animals. Now we have emerging infectious diseases that are novel diseases that we have no experience with that come from the wild, like Ebola, HIV. But then, 10,000 years ago, the diseases of tuberculosis, influenza comes from chickens and ducks, smallpox, cows, a host of other, malaria, other diseases, yellow fever, these became epidemic because people were clustered together in these larger communities and they had no immunity to these previously animal-born disease pools. And it ran rampant throughout the population. So when the first Europeans came to what's now America, they brought with them these diseases that they had somewhat developed an uncomfortable immunity to. They lived within them. They didn't kill them, but they carried them with them. But the Native Americans had no experience. And so Cortez, in about 1650, when he came to Mexico City, started at the coast, he had about 600 men, a few horses, and some very rudimentary guns. And with that, he conquered an entire civilization and almost wiped it off the face of the earth. In fact, there's not much left to the Aztecs except the pyramids and other implements that they were able to leave. And so why was 600 men able to do this, conquer a great empire, a well-developed culture, millions of people? How was he able to do that?
Disease.
Moving before him, smallpox. And so by the time he got to Tenochtitlan, the lakes that now make Mexico City, all of the Royal Guard of the emperor was killed. So Moctezuma was captured, and thereafter, the same thing happened with Pizarro and Atahualpa in Peru. 95% of the Native Americans in all what's now North, South, and Central America were killed from these infectious diseases. That was the situation that your ancestors came to in Charlestown. Now, there weren't that many endemic disease pools in the New World, but nevertheless, these epidemics that started 10,000 years ago continue to roll through Charlestown. Yellow fever, malaria, smallpox were the main ones. So Charlestown was an epidemiological disaster. But the good news is that there was a local form of government there, and there was the same, almost identical local form of somewhat government here in St. Matthews. Ms. Waters told me about the St. Matthews Vestry Minutes, and I looked at that, and I spent untold years reading the Vestry Minutes of St. Philip's Church to learn about that work, that important work. And so in Charlestown, every Easter, and it happened here, every Easter they elected 7 church vestrymen and 2 church wardens. So what was the job of the vestryman?
Keep
the vestrymen ran what was there in terms of local government. They also elected fire wardens and people to handle weights and measures and provide a rudimentary watch system and police system, prisons and things of that nature. But their main job was to provide poor relief to a lot of the immigrants coming in and the people who lived in Charlestown, because at any point, the average person, average lifespan was into the mid-20s. Many people died in childbirth, or infant deaths were very high. And so sickness and death were everywhere. And there was a real sense of community. So their job number one was to take care of one another. They were barely making it, even those that were well off. Now, later on, that was not true of everyone. But in the beginning, that was the way things were organized. They financed this through a poor tax. Anglican male property owners paid a poor tax. Now, later on, there was considerable wealth in Charlestown and the surrounding areas. There were members of the vestry. One member in particular, Joseph Manigo, was one of the vestrymen. He was the wealthiest person in British North America at the time, on plantations outside of Charlestown. These were very powerful, influential people and very wealthy people later on. So Charles Cotesworth Pinckney ran for president and vice president and secretary of state. He was ambassador to France or Spain, one of those countries, I can't remember. John Rutledge, his brother, Edward, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. Fabulously powerful, elite people. Their wealth came from what? The streets of Charlestown were paved with gold, or so the European immigrants were told when they signed up to come here. Where did the wealth come from? Rice and slavery, and the people, the slave importers, and some of them were on the vestry. Thomas Smith was one of the wealthiest people in the world, imported slaves. They were very bright, and they figured out that the slaves that came from the area between Senegal and Gambia River knew how to grow rice, and so they particularly prized those slaves and tried to bring them there. But that wealth was based upon slavery. But they saw the economic value of trade, particularly with Europe. But where were they going to get the trade goods? Because Charlestown was isolated there on that peninsula, and there's some very good farmland around Charlestown, but not enough to support a large trade establishment in furs, naval stores, and other goods, lumber. So where were they to get those trade goods from but bring in settlers from all over Western Europe? Came in through Charlestown. They came in through various methods. A lot of them came as indentured servants. Others came as a part of an organized group, such as the Swiss going to Perrysburg. There were other, later on, there were Irish groups that came through. But the job of the vestry was to provide social services and poor relief to those people. So, told Dr. Sally that I would talk. I'm not getting any questions, so I'm going to keep talking. So if you have any questions, ask them. Told Dr. Sally I would talk about the very first hospital one of the first in the whole United States that was in Charlestown. It was authorized by the General Assembly in 1732. And I have somewhere here the original act, copy of the original act. This is a photocopy. Reverend, can you read this for us?
I'll sure be trying. And be it further enacted by the authority aforesaid that the said commissioners of the poor or any three of them who shall meet on 3 days given for that purpose shall and may, and they are hereby authorized and empowered to raise by assessment all and every inhabitant, owners and proprietors of slaves and stock and cash in the said parish.
That's great. So thank you. And they raise money to establish a workhouse and a hospital. So,
what do you mean workhouse?
Okay, good question. That's a great question. So these the early vestrymen and church wardens and the population were acting not entirely out of a feeling of charity toward others, and they were particularly concerned about idle, vicious, lewd, and otherwise criminal people who might be out there who could work but were not working and would take advantage of their charity. And so they established as a deterrent factor a workhouse. And its secondary purpose was as a hospital. And so if you look at the very first 9 persons that were in that early hospital, it opened in 1736. There was a lame man, a young man disordered in his senses, a Swiss woman who was lame. And so they had a list of these people. They were similar to persons that we would think of as persons needing, they were, had a disability and needed care. They could not care for themselves. Those people went to the hospital. Now, before that, they were caring for people in their homes on what's called outrelief. But they were concerned that that was too easy and would create some sort of disincentive. They needed to create a disincentive for people to live in the homes and in the community. So they created this workhouse slash hospital as a deterrent. And one of my favorite stories is Charles Dickens, The Christmas Story. So you remember what Scrooge said about the workhouse there, that those who need charity need to go to the workhouse. And then the commissioners said that were collecting for the poor said basically no one would go there but upon threat of death. They would rather go there, they would rather die than go there. And so that was about why they established the workhouse. It was also had a third purpose, and they had stocks and fetters to punish the runaway slaves that were captured, and would advertise in the Charlestown Gazette these characteristics of these runaway slaves, and they were also kept there in that workhouse slash hospital. Runaway indentured servants were also kept there. That was the first hospital, one of the first in the United States. The one in Philadelphia was a little bit earlier. I think in terms of time, this was the second one in the United States. And until somewhat after 1880, 1890, when a couple of wonderful discoveries occurred, a hospital was someplace that no one wanted to go because infection and infectious diseases and germs were rampant in hospitals. You never wanted to go to the hospital unless upon threat of death. So what were the discoveries? A Pasteur in France. They studied the germ theory and developed the germ theory and identified the specific organisms, Koch in Germany, and Joseph Lister in Scotland developed a method of antiseptic surgery. Those revolutionized hospital care. And all of a sudden, hospitals and physicians could make a difference. Up until then, even Greek and Roman physicians really didn't have the tools to make much of a difference in the health. And Joseph Lister in Scotland was a wonderful surgeon, but more than half of his patients died of infection that he operated on because of the presence of germs. It wasn't well understood. And often having blood-stained clothing and not cleaning the instruments was a badge of courage and a sign of experience for physicians, and they didn't really understand that. They thought before that that it was miasma, something bad in the air. And the people in Charlestown, 100 years before that, that's what they thought caused these epidemic deaths of smallpox, of malaria, and yellow fever. They came out of the air. They did not understand where they came from. So your ancestors came into an area, and infectious disease, a chronic disease, my specialty, it discriminates between rich and poor. It seeks out the poor and vulnerable members of society. But infectious disease doesn't care. It goes after everybody. And that's what happened. And so there was no means of preventing it. In fact, the rudimentary care that was available was no help at all. And as I said earlier, you did not ever want to go to a hospital. So the hospital workhouse / prison was there as a deterrent, really against people who might otherwise take advantage of the poor relief system. Yes?
The vestry, how they determined who got help and who didn't?
Great question. So here, I showed the Reverend, this is the way the vestry minutes were written. Beautiful penmanship, but I had difficulty reading 100 years of vestry minutes and of account books written like this. Margaret had directed me to the St. Matthew's vestry minutes. They are identical to those that I found in Charleston. The only difference was the names. Identical, same circumstances, same method of taxation. So they met less frequently, but every week they would meet in the vestry chambers. The vestry was a policy-making arm. The church wardens performed the role that we think of now as a social worker. But these were really wealthy people. Henry Lawrence was a vestryman. He was the second president of the U.S. Continental Congress, a fabulously wealthy person. Joseph Pringle, I think his name was Joseph, I'm not sure, was another vestryman. So these were very wealthy people. So they, people would come to them or neighbors would come and bring cases to them. They would investigate. And if they felt like the person was worthy, And that's a big distinction that they had to make. They could do one of two things. Generally, they would bring that case to the vestry and discuss it, and the minutes would reflect that case. So what I did in my dissertation is I was able to, a wonderful lady, Mrs. Elf, was paid by the WPA to type these things up just for me. Imagine that. And so I put all of these names in the computer and linked them up and was able to come up with stories about these people through that. So I developed, that was my dissertation. I came up with stories. Now, today, when you guys went to school, and same when I went to school, history was about wealthy white men. It wasn't about anybody else. No ordinary people ever appeared in history books. So we don't know anything about ordinary people. With this, we know about the lives of ordinary people. And so that's what I did. And yes.
I've kind of got two questions. One steps back a little bit, and you may want to address that in a minute. And that is, you mentioned that Charleston had a much higher rate of mortality at certain points in time from the other areas that were keeping records. I'm not sure that I understood what the answer was as to why that
you
was.
You guys, thank you so much for asking that. So there,
would you repeat that question?
So the question,
so we could all hear.
Very good. So why did Charleston have such a high rate? So let's think about Ebola. You should know quite a bit about Ebola, even though every day, all over the world, 5,000 children die of malaria every day. We're really concerned here about one person that's died of Ebola in the United States. We don't care about those 5,000 people that die every day of a preventable disease called malaria. But that's another story. So a lot of these disease pools that come from wild animals like Ebola and HIV, and the earliest humans, it was a great step forward when they came down out of the trees in the rainforest, probably in what's now West Africa or the Rift Valley, but we don't know, that's where the surviving fossil record is. Came down, and then it was not a dry, arid area, it was a rainforest. In that area, in those treetops, in that very moist, hot area, microparasites thrived, and humans could not get ahead. And so, as soon as I'm out of my league when I start talking about this, but there were some developments that today those who study things call them orthogenic spurts, where humans kind of leapt ahead for just a moment ahead of the microparasites. Walking upright was one of them. Being able to communicate was another. Invention of clothes was another. When they invented clothes and could walk upright, they could begin to get to cooler, drier areas. And where the parasitic gradient, high levels where of parasites, microparasites, in the warm, moist areas, tropical rainforests, and move out past the Mediterranean into Western Europe, up into the mountainous areas, cooler, drier areas, many fewer microparasites. So think about that today. Charlestown, Orangeburg is not that far removed. I happen to live in Charleston for 4 years, and very hot and very moist, like West Africa. Perfect environment for these microparasites. But the kinds of bugs that were prevalent there were different than the bugs that were prevalent in some of the other cities. Now, one of the greatest outbreaks in history of epidemic disease happened in Philadelphia and yellow fever. And smallpox was still a problem in Boston and New York, malaria as well, but it was more prevalent in South Carolina and particularly in Charleston along the coast. So did that answer your question?
The answer is humidity.
Good for the bugs. And this is another thing that I teach my students, and maybe you can answer this question. Throughout history, humans have been in conflict with these microparasites. And so humans would make an advance, the microparasites would catch up. So in a conflict like that, who is ultimately going to win, the humans or the microparasites?
The parasites.
The parasites, because why?
Too many,
and they can change very quickly, go through many iterations. So we develop a vaccine or an antibiotic. They develop a countermeasure. They're smarter than we are. They're working in their little laboratories developing these measures all the time. And so eventually they will outsmart us. And it takes a novel disease, one to which we have no experience, like the Incas and the Aztecs, to wipe out an entire population. In Western Europe, starting in 1349, there were these burrowing rodents on the steppes and plains in Central Asia, what's now called Manchuria, and there was a drought, so they had to find something to drink. So they went to these little villages, carrying with them fleas and this parasite, Yersinia pestis, bubonic plague, that then the fleas bit rats and mice in these little villages and bit humans. Living in those villages were people related to the Mongols who raced across Europe both ways and toward Asia carrying Yersinia pestis, the black plague, and with it the fleas and the black rats as well. And some of those cousins of those same rats were on the ships that the Spanish brought into Mexico and into Cusco and Peru, and also into Charlestown. And so Charlestown was a great habitat for infectious disease. So tell me about time now. How are we doing?
5 more minutes.
Okay, so let me get the final exam ready for you here. So now we die of something different. I talked with you about the first two causes of disease, but I don't think I ever mentioned the third general cause. So what's the leading cause of death in South Carolina and the U.S.?
Heart
disease. Good. You guys are really smart. Second?
Cancer.
Third? Stroke?
Obesity.
Well, good answer, but wrong. That is an underlying cause of death, a behavioral cause, but that's, I teach my students this all the time, so that's really good. That causes the causes of death, underlying cause. What is the leading underlying cause of death in the U.S.? I just attended that training today in a new method of screening for lung cancer.
What?
Cigarettes?
Tobacco.
And it not only causes lung cancer, many other types of cancers as well, and heart disease and diabetes, a risk factor for all of those. Lots of problems, but I digress. So the third type of disease So what we have is called the epidemiological transition. You guys that are taking notes, my students never take notes. I'm really impressed. You'll do well on the final exam. They know, all they have to do is go to YouTube and watch the video. And I give the exams online, and so they look up the question, and then they go watch the video, and they come back and write the answer. Anyway, they get it right. But, so, epidemiological transition from infectious disease to chronic disease, when did that occur? And when was the original research done on the underlying cause of chronic disease? And where was it done? So if you said 1920 in Spartanburg, South Carolina, you would be right. So one of the probably three greatest political figures in South Carolina, and arguably in the South, were John C. Calhoun, Strom Thurmond, and who else? Served in all three branches of the federal government, including governor of South Carolina. James F. Burns. His statue is on the corner of the State House grounds with his back toward the people of South Carolina. It used to be facing the people of South Carolina, but he was so embarrassed by what he did over this incident. In the middle of the night, that statue turned on its axis, turned and its back now faces the people of South Carolina. So this is what he did. After the Civil War, Southerners were impoverished. To have a new start, they took from the North an interest in manufacturing, and along the fall line, they had a commodity that they could grow agriculturally. What was that commodity? It replaced the white gold of rice, cotton. So all of a sudden, they started growing cotton everywhere. Everybody grew cotton, and they developed textile mills. My father was a textile engineer. It was the rocket science of the time. I lived in like 16 different places before I went to college, moving from little textile village to little textile village. And these are all the same. So Jimmy Burns, when he was a congressman, called up to Congress. He probably wrote him a letter or something. He was up there. He said, there's this mystery disease here in South Carolina we've never seen before. People have this butterfly rash, this dermatitis, diarrhea. They get demented and they end up in the state hospital and they die. And the mortality rate is about 50%. And thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people all over the South are developing this mystery disease. So I'm in public health, and so sorry about this, Dr. Sally, but since the last 200 years, the great advances in life expectancy have not come from medicine, they come from public health. And so this is one of the big advances in public health. There are many others. So they sent Joseph Goldberger, who was a physician, and Edgar Seidenstreicher, who was a biostatistician, epidemiologist, down to Spartanburg. And they began to visit, very methodically, seven little mill villages. They also went to the South Carolina State Hospital and to orphanages. And they noticed at State Hospital that only the patients got this mystery disease. And the staff and physicians never got it. And the orphanage is, the orphans got it. The staff never got it. And in the mill villages, has anybody grown up in a mill village here? Well, I did. And down at the bottom near the river that generated the hydropower, it's where the poor people lived, the mill workers. The supervisors and boss men lived in big white houses up the hill. they noticed that women and children living down by the river got this mystery disease. But generally, the men living didn't get it. And almost no one got it in these houses of the supervisors. So, final exam, what's the name of that mystery disease?
Pellagra.
Yes, very good. You guys are outstanding. So they said, they went house to house and they looked at what people ate. And the time, the diet, was the four, so three M's. Three M's. What are those three M's? What do you think?
Molasses.
Blackstrap molasses.
Meal.
Cornmeal.
No.
Third is meat, but it was fat back. That was the diet. It was very low in niacin, tryptophan, which is the basic amino acid that the absence of which causes pellagra. And so they wrote back to Congress. Maybe they called them because there were phones at the time, and they said, this is a disease. It's not an infectious disease, as Governor Burns thought. This is a disease caused by poverty, by living conditions in the community, the social environment.
And I thought it was mosquitoes that caused malaria.
Well, we're talking about pellagra now.
Oh,
yeah.
You're right. Mosquitoes did. But we're talking about pellagra. And so at the time, I think Burns was in Congress, he had them kicked out, Goldberger and Steinstreicher, kicked out of South Carolina. They went to Georgia, studied orphans, Alabama, studied mental hospitals, and they went to Mississippi. In every place they did these experiments, they changed the diet in the orphanages, and all of a sudden the orphans got better. It changed the diet in the mental hospitals. But in Mississippi, they did something we would not be able to do today in public health. We have something called Institutional Review Board that would not allow us to experiment on human subjects. But they got a group of prisoners and said, if you will eat our diet that we will feed you for, I think, like 3 months, after that, you will get a full pardon. We'll let you go. And we promise there won't be any long-term results. And so they fed them a diet of grits and cornmeal and fat back and molasses, and they got pellagra. They reversed it and fed them fresh fruits and vegetables and meat. It went away, and they got a pardon. Goldberger died before he knew what the cause was. But that's kicked off. This was about the time where the transition, no longer today, do most of the people in the United States die from infectious disease. Now it's chronic disease, the ones that you guys named. Now, that's not the case all over the world. The leading cause of death all over the world is still infectious disease. We've got a way to go. But the bugs, remember what I told you, the bugs are smart. They were smart back in 1750s. So these new emerging infectious diseases are coming back. So that's all the time I have. I have a lot more stories. So I really enjoyed speaking with you today. You're a really smart class. Yes.
Can we get a copy of your dissertation to read? Where is it? Is it online?
Why don't I send Ms. Waters email it to them, a Word copy of it.
Thank you.
And I'll send it to Annette, too. And so, again, thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me here. Thank you.